in worship. You've taken the time to come and join us this afternoon, and encourage us to remember the Lord is with us, and we desire to know him more nearly and to be led by him in our work and ministry. So thank you, Paul, and thank you, Mark, for joining us at this point. And welcome again to others. Now, we have our formal introductions a bit later because we wanted to start at full speed with our keynote speaker. And after we've heard our keynote speaker, that will get our brains into gear. And then we can be meditating on that as we have a tea break and go into introductions in an hour's time. So, Vulnerable Mission, you're aware, is the theme. And it's been our privilege in the Alliance of Vulnerable Mission to have a close link with an organization called WMA, World Mission Associates. It's been around for, I think, 30 or so years, and been looking at concerns that are very closely related to those that we consider in the Alliance of Vulnerable Mission, particularly unhealthy dependency. Now, a few years ago, I began to see that there was a new person on board looking at these issues and very concerned about these issues. I had the privilege to meet Jean the first time in March last year in a conference in the US, and I'm very, very grateful that she agreed to take her time to come and spend these 2 weeks in the UK, including this conference, and be our keynote speaker. Jean has an incredible testimony. She'll no doubt add to it herself, but not only did she go to Cambodia for many, many years, but because the door to Cambodia was closed, initially she lived with a Cambodian family right there in the US and went to Cambodia already knowing the Cambodian language fluently. That takes an incredible degree of dedication. So she served in Cambodia in church planting and related ministries for a long time, and in that time became more and more convinced of the serious concerns that are there in the generation of dependency by church workers in places like Cambodia that are also happening in other parts of the world. So these days she's full-time occupied in raising awareness of these issues, encouraging missionaries into better practice. And it's an enormous privilege for us to be able to invite Jean to continue to introduce herself as she sees fit, and then to share that which the Lord has laid on her heart to give us in this keynote address. Welcome to Jean. Thank you very much.
It's a wonderful opportunity to be with you this afternoon. Before we get started, I think even though it's written behind me in front of you, the explanation of what vulnerable mission means, and I'd like to read it because this will set sort of the circumference, it'll set the sort of boundaries of our conference today. Alliance for Vulnerable Mission believes that some Western missionaries should carry out their, or in parentheses, a key ministry outside of the West using local languages and local resources. So just wanted to make sure we were all on the same page, because Vulnerable Mission can be a confusing title. You might be led to think that Vulnerable Mission means working among the vulnerable. So that could be confusing. So I wanted to set the pace this afternoon by reading that definition. I think many of us, I haven't met everybody, I don't know exactly what your backgrounds are, but I think amongst us we have some mission practitioners, people who have done missions on the ground or people who are preparing to do missions, and those that somehow influence missions. So at the least I can say we're all missions-minded here. And before we start, I think, do you know the story of Frankenstein? Have you ever heard of Frankenstein? Well, I'm not even sure how the story goes. I just remember as a little girl hearing about Frankenstein. And if I think I'm correct, the person who made the man, who set out to make this man, set out to make a man that would do good things and get good things done, but somehow it backfired and that good thing turned in sort of into a Frankenstein. And I was just thinking while I was sitting there, a little story about when a few years back, I was looking at a flock of birds. They were actually geese. And one of the goose had a broken wing, so it could not fly. And I felt pity, I felt compassion for that goose because he could not fend for himself, he could not get food. So I made it my mandate to take care of that goose, not take it in and create a pet out of it, but I decided that I would go out and feed the goose, that I would provide it with food. Now, initially, it looked good. It looked good, and I would watch with a smile on my face as I fed that goose, and that goose took in the food, and he was looked like he was getting along fairly better. But it backfired. How do you think it backfired? I entered into the animal kingdom, cross-cultural ministry, right? I entered into the animal kingdom with the intentions of fixing something that I knew nothing about. I entered with the intentions to help a goose who was ostracized from the other geese, who could not fend for himself, and I decided that I would pitch in from my frame of reference, from my context. Well, eventually what happened is all the other geese became upset at this particular goose. And before my very eyes, attacked that goose and killed it. So, point made, many things that look good also have a flip side to it. And I was thinking about globalization this morning. Now, I think globalization might have two sides to it. Because on one hand, we're excited about globalization. It's an opportunity to travel places we could never travel, to get messages and communication expediently, opens doors for all kinds of things. But as a missionaries and cross-cultural communicators, because globalization is active, I think that we need to sit at the table and talk constantly. Because I think also that globalization is a wild beast that can be out of control and out of our hands, and things can happen. I know, for example, with globalization, two things are happening like never before. Resources from the Western world can get over to the rest of the world, what some people call third world or majority world, like never before. For example, in my hometown in Minnesota, the United States, in my newspaper, it was talking about one church in Mexico that was painted 6 times by visiting teams from the West, one church in 3 months. So globalization, yes, exciting, but it also means that things are happening and getting done and being done at a very rapid pace. And secondly, there's the area of languages. Now, when I went to Cambodia, there weren't trade languages and local languages per se. Most of the country spoke Cambodian unless you went to the tribal group. So when I went to Cambodia, all I knew is you learn the language and speak the language. But it wasn't until I began traveling to places like Africa that I began to see a whole different realm. You know, Jim, when you first started talking about local languages, and I began hearing him, like, I don't get it, why everybody learns the language. But as I began to realize, for example, in Africa, I'm going to use your village, the Luo, I could be sitting in a family as a visitor, as a Western visitor, sitting in their home, and I could hear perhaps the husband and wife sitting somewhere together talking maybe intensely about one of their children taking exams or something in their local heart language, the Luo language. But then I can walk out of that house and go to a conference and walk into the conference and there's several people from several villages who are speaking Kiswahili to one another. And then, of course, the conference has a Westerner who's speaking, so then it goes from Kiswahili to English. So I'm only bringing these things up because these are the things we need to think about. That's what we're doing in this conference. When resources can get somewhere else overnight, where before it might have taken months and months and months, where now people seem to be wanting to speak English more than ever before, what do we do with these situations? How do we respond? How does Gene Johnson enter into the cross culture of the geese and get involved without hurting? And that's a bit what this conference is about. I'd like to begin. My paper is called Vulnerable Mission is Worth a Second Look. And I will read the first paragraph of my paper, and then I will continue. I will not read the whole thing to you. I'd like to read the beginning. I could see that we were in big trouble. The Cambodian pastor and I had teamed up to motivate and train church planters from his church. The very first session, we made the following request to the new church planters. Please share your experience in coming to faith in Jesus Christ. The first man shared how a Christian organization gave out free glasses, and this was the trigger to his belief in Jesus. Another man talked about how his family received rice, and yet another how he received a piece of land. The same testimonies continued. All I could think is, we are in trouble. I kept my concerns to myself. About a month later, sitting in a circle on the same woven mat with the same church planters, they began to say, "Hey, Pastor, hey, Missionary Gene." They said, they begin to ask for glasses and rice in land so that they had perks to share with their neighbors as they shared the good news. In this case, a cycle of dependency was well on its way. As Jim shared, I graduated from college and had the desire to go to Cambodia. But Cambodia was a closed country. It was post-genocide. It was in the midst of civil war. It was communist. No such thing for an American to go to Cambodia. But then I felt God put on my heart, don't think about a place, think about a people. What that meant is, Gene, you have 4,000 refugees who escaped Cambodia living in your own hometown. Why not start there? So I did. The day that I graduated from college, about a week later, I found a Cambodian family living in the inner city of where I'm from, St. Paul, Minneapolis. There were 8 members living in a 1-bedroom house. And I knocked on the door and said, "Do you have room for 9 people? Can I live with you?" They took me in. They already had beds in the kitchen. So they set up a little place for me to sleep in their hallway. And there I began to do life with the Cambodians. Because I had believed, I had formed a philosophy in my mind that I could not leave my middle-class suburban neighborhood, drive in my parents' car, go into the Cambodian community, sit with them, talk about Jesus, then hop in my car and go back somewhere else. Come in on a daily basis, outsider in for a few minutes, outsider in for a few days, outsider, insider. But I believed that it was my role to move in as an insider, to be one of them. I made sure that my income was no more or no more or less than they made, because I didn't want to come in as a patron, as some kind of hero to save the day or fix them. And so there I lived among them, and I learned the language and the culture. I continued that process for the next 6 years. Wherever the Cambodian lived, I moved in and did life with them and learned the language. But eventually, Cambodia opened up. And I had the opportunity to go there in 1992. But people started to ask me, "Hey, Gene, heard you're going to Cambodia. What great thing are you going to do there? Are you going to start an orphanage?" I said to myself, "An orphanage? I don't even know how to do an orphanage in America. What do you mean an orphanage? I'm just going to go there and do what I did here in Minnesota. And the next person, Jean, what great, amazing thing are you going to do in Cambodia? Start a school? Help children go to school? Feed the poor? I didn't know that's what missions was. I didn't know what missions was all about. But I began to be fed a steady diet that when you're a missionary and you're leaving from a country that's more well off and entering into a country of disparity and poverty, I was beginning to believe, unlike my time in Minnesota, Minneapolis, St. Paul, that I was supposed to go with the gospel and a whole boatload of money, resources, that I was to bring my resources with me, that I was to already, standing in America, never stood in Cambodia one time, I'm already supposed to be dreaming what ministry I'm going to set up and what resources I'll bring with me. So I went to Cambodia, and sure enough, it's exactly what I did. Now my goal was this, to make disciples who have the spiritual authority, vision, and capability to reproduce themselves. That was my goal. But my means were this. I conceptualized and organized the church in Cambodia based on my church experience in America. And when I begin to unfold church like that, the Cambodians, not verbally, not consciously, but unconsciously were saying, Gene, we can't do church like you do it. We don't have the forms and the structures. It's too expensive. But I reasoned in my mind, it's okay. Don't worry about it. For right now, I'll take care of it. I'll pay for it. And when you're mature in God, I'll wean away little by little, and you'll mature in God, and you'll turn to me and say, no, Jean, we're ready, we'll take responsibility. Because there's this thinking that we can pour out the resources, and then eventually people will begin to take responsibility. Well, I found out that that's not true. It didn't happen, because this is why. In Cambodia, they'll often take an elephant and put a chain around the ankle of the elephant and then tie it to the base of a tree. The elephant will go around and around and around the tree in a circle all this long. And then, when it's an adult, they'll come and they'll cut the chain on the tree. I'm sorry, the chain on the elephant. And in my mind, I'm like, okay, you're an adult elephant. Go and be free. Enjoy the jungle, which you were meant for. But what does that mature adult elephant do? Circles around and around and around. Because when you use local resources, it's done in a context, and a context affects it. And so what I had done in Cambodia is I had created elephants that were going around the tree, Cambodian nationals that were going around the tree saying, we can't do it like you, Jean. We can't afford the way you do it. Why should we do it? If you're going to take care of our orphans, why should we take care of our orphans? If you're going to take care of our sick, why should we bother to take care of our sick? If you're going to pay church pastors, why should we pay our church pastors? If our church pastor is getting paid, why should we as Christians tithe to give to our own church? And you end up with the elephant going around the tree. Ultimately, it's called unhealthy dependency, or that's what I call it. Steve Saint says, dependency is not a welfare condition. It becomes an insidious state of mind that can debilitate generation after generation once it gains a foothold. What I'm heading towards is thinking about all these things. My mindset was not this. Obviously, the language was, but the local resources. I conceptualize and organize the mission task in somebody else's country as a Westerner based on the resources I could bring into the picture. Many of you have heard of Jonathan Bonk. He made a quote that's forever haunted me that I carry in my mind quite a bit. He says, material and economic abundance has been a hallmark of the modus operandi of Western missionaries throughout the past two centuries. In sharp contrast to their apostolic counterparts of the first century, portrayed by St. Paul, is being on display at the end of the procession like men condemned to die in the arena. Missionaries from Europe and Americas have, with some notable exceptions, manifested escalating levels of economic material entitlement beyond the dreams of a majority of a world's population. I don't think any of us can deny the fact that mission strategies coming from the West today are money intensive. And yet, it's true, we are hard-pressed to find apostolic examples in which heaps of money, a pipeline of money, was part of their mission strategy. In actuality, if you just sit with the Bible and you look at Jesus, the disciples, and Paul, they left money out of the picture for the most part, for the most part. And so what I would like to suggest today is that Jesus and the disciples and Paul, whatnot, they used a vulnerable positioning in missions, and I think it's worth a second look during this time where globalization is wide open. I suggest that vulnerable positioning relates to at least the following: attitudes, methods, reasoning, and communication. And I'd like to go over those four areas this afternoon with you. Vulnerable attitude, what does that look like? What do I think that looks like? Paul describes it as this: "And so it was with me, brothers and sisters. When I came to you, I did not come with eloquence or human wisdom, as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God. For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I came to you in weakness, with great fear and trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with the demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power. When I went to Cambodia, I began to form this concept that I was to go in with eloquence, with wisdom, with expertise, with lots of money and resources. That's how I was beginning to be informed. And so when I wrote a book, you'll be surprised that the title is not We Are the Hero, but We Are Not the Hero. You see, this is kind of what happened to me. I fell into the lie that, you know, if I were honest with you, thinking about missions, maybe one of the reasons I wanted to go to Cambodians is because I knew they were poor. Now you're saying, well, yeah, you are driven to alleviate poverty, to help the poor. But if I were to really search my heart, and you were to put before me, here's a people group, Gene, that you can go to that are poor. Here's a people group that are middle class, just like you, still unreached. Which one would I pick? Years ago, my thinking, I would pick the poor. Do you know why? Because I feel like I could position myself in such a way that they would need me, because they're poor. So I'm not afraid of them. I'm not afraid to share the gospel with them because they're poor, because I can come and do free things for them and give them resources and position myself with my status and expertise that I know that they'll need me. And if people need me, then they'll listen to the gospel. The thing I found out in Cambodia and the rest of the world is this is my concern. This is where it breaks down. This is where bringing all our resources brings harm, like when I tried to reach out to the goose. I had this bright idea in Cambodia. I decided I would bring a medical team from America, outside resources, and work with a local church and set some local church people up with these medical doctors. And they would take medicine from the outside that the doctors brought with them and team that medical team up from America with a Cambodian and go from house to house and share the gospel and also do checkups, health checkups, and these doctors from the West would give out vitamins, malaria pills, and whatnot. And my big idea is I will help the Cambodians to have an inroad and for me to have an inroad to share the gospel. Well, at the end of the day, the medical doctors came back. They said it went wonderful. So many families gave their life to Jesus. And then they said to the local Cambodian Christian church, you need to visit this family. They gave their life to Christ and they want to come to church. You need to visit that family. They prayed the sinner's prayer and they want to come to church. Well, the Cambodians did that. But when they went to the houses, they didn't have hands full of medicine. They had an orange or two, some fruit. And when they went to the houses, those Cambodians who assumedly became Christians began to yell at them and say, "Who are you? Why did you forsake Buddhism? What are you doing here? We don't care about you. You're rotten. You're terrible. Oh, and bring those visitors back. When are those American doctors coming back?" And what I had realized is that they were saying to me, "Gene, you can't come to our country with your outside resources and buy your acceptance into a community." Because that's what, as Western missionaries, we tend, as soon as we want to reach, not everybody, but a lot of us, as soon as we want to reach a community, we think of some heroic way to connect with that community to buy our acceptance. Here, I'm here, I've been here two weeks, I'd like to help you build a school. Or I've been here a month and I would like to, you become a power broker, patron-client relationship. But those local leaders, when it's their turn to go to a community, they can't buy their way into acceptance. They can't make themselves needed because they're at the same economic level as the other people. They have to win their acceptance over time. It is my belief that Westerners need to take a second look at what it means to come into weakness with great fear and trembling, so that others' faith might not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power. The second one is vulnerable resources. I was with a group of international leaders, and we had a board such as that, and we drew a box, an empty box. And there were some Africans there, some leaders from South America and whatnot, and I asked them to write everything in the box that they think they need to do church or to do God's kingdom. So they began to write. Microphones. What else? You come with me. What else do we need to do church? Loudspeakers. What else? Big drum sets. What? Guitars. What else? Car. Petrol. Computer. Buildings. Constitutions. Heaters and air conditionings. Technicians. What is that? Clothes. Certain kinds of clothes. Robes. Candles. On and on and on and on, and they filled that box, and they filled that box, and they filled that box. It was filled from every corner. And then we talked about how expensive is that box. Very expensive. And then after that, I split them into about 10 groups, and I gave them 10, 12 groups, and I gave them 10 or 12 Bible stories from the book of Acts. And I told them to write down in their square all the resources that were used in that church planning setting or discipleship making setting. And we're going to do one together. We're going to pick a Bible story and we're going to fill the box with all the resources that you need to do church. Okay? Let's do that together. You know the story of Philip and the Ethiopian. I don't think I need to tell you the story. So let's go at it. Let's fill our box. What did Philip and the Ethiopian government official that came to do the bidding of the queen of Ethiopia. Oh, thank you, you're such a dear. Coconut juice. So let's fill the box. What did they need? What did they need to do church? Okay, they had a chariot. There was a chariot. Running shoes. The book, the Bible, the scroll, that book of Isaiah he had. Okay, book of Isaiah, chariot. What else? Two people talking to each other. Water for the baptism. The Mediterranean water. We got to define that kind of water. Holy Spirit. How expensive was that? The chariot was... But it was provided, it was there. They didn't order up, you know, they didn't order up the chariot from America and have it shipped in containers, right? Yeah, right. Only to say that those leaders from Africa, they just sat there. And they just started to talk among themselves, and they're like, yes. Somehow we've been led to believe that Christianity is so incredibly expensive. But what we're promoting is if we can encourage local languages and local resources, people can do church. You need a person to explain the scriptures, as Philip did to the Ethiopian. The chariot was already going along. I don't know if Philip had running shoes on, but I think he might have had sandals, but I'm not sure. This is what Roland Allen, isn't he an English missionary? Roland Allen. He says this: St. Paul's method is not in harmony with the modern Western spirit. We modern teachers from the West are by nature and by training persons of restless activity and boundless self-confidence. We are accustomed to assuming an attitude of superiority towards Eastern peoples, and to the point to our material progress as the justification of our attitude. We are accustomed by tradition to an elaborate system of church organization and a peculiar code of morality. We cannot imagine any Christianity worthy of the name existing without the elaborate machinery that we invented and now import into other countries. Or you could say export, depending on which angle you're looking at it. We naturally expect our converts to adopt from us not only our essentials, but our accidentals. It is my belief that we Westerners need to take a second look at what it means to leave our elaborate machinery and accidentals at home and promote the mobilization of local resources. The third area, and coming closer to an end, actually I have two. One is vulnerable reasoning, and I'm not going to take real long on that. It's just the basic concept of what is vulnerable reasoning. I think of Paul when he was trying to reason out how he should go about his ministry. And he talked about in Corinthians chapter 9, we're familiar, where he was talking about rights. You know, that it is written that do not muzzle an ox while it is treading the grain. It is about oxen that God's concerned. Surely he says this for us, doesn't he? And he goes on to say, if we have sown a spiritual seed among you, is it too much if we reap a material harvest from you? So he's going on to kind of describe the landscape and the rights. But he ends it with, but we did not use this right. On the contrary, we put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. To me, vulnerable reasoning is this. I was taught to ask what I call a powerhouse question, what I say a non-vulnerable question, and it's this. What should I do to forward the gospel? What can I do? What can I pay for? What can I bring into the equation? What can I do to forward the gospel? But I would like to suggest to us, those who are practicing missions, that we use a vulnerable strategic question like Paul and say, what will we bear or put up with that we may cause no hindrance to the gospel of Christ? When I start asking that strategic vulnerable question, it changes the way I do things. There's many things that I could have used to forward Gene Johnson's ministry in Cambodia. But I had to put up with things so that it was the Cambodians who ultimately could be the ones to perpetuate and multiply and make disciples and plant churches without any necessary reference to the missionary from the West. The last area is vulnerable communication. I think every missionary loves Acts 17. When Paul was waiting for Timothy and he was in Athens, he was waiting. And the scripture said he started out first wandering around in the marketplace. We all know that in countries the marketplace is sort of the heat, the energy of the local community. If you want to know what's going on, the local gossip, who thinks about what, how the economy is working, you go to the market. Paul went to the market, but he didn't stop at the market. He eventually ended up in the Areopagus. This kind of rock cropping out, known in that particular culture in Athens, where the intellectuals regularly gathered for debate, and they would philosophize. Well, Paul entered. He didn't invite them to, which I, you know, some people do as missionaries, let's set up an English center and invite people into my comfort zone. I will invite Cambodians who think Jesus is the foreigner's God, and I will invite them into my English center to teach them English so they do get to know that Jesus is the foreigner God, because I'm bringing Christ to them in my language. But in this case, Paul jumped into the middle and the heart of their culture. And not only that, but we know as he began to share the gospel, he would walk about and he said, you know, I've walked through your streets. I've observed your strong and diverse religious ethos. You're truly a religious people. I've stopped again and again to examine carefully the religious statues and inscriptions that fill your city. On one such altar, I read this inscription to an unknown God. And then he goes on to tell them who that God is, God, the creator of the heavens and earth. But even while he's talking about that, he uses their poems and their poetry. If you remember, as he goes through that discourse, he says, you know the saying. You have your own poem that says, we live in God, or proverb, we live in God and we move in God and exist in God. I'm bringing that all up to say my final thing. I believe vulnerable language, we can broaden that to say, I believe it's our responsibility when we go to another country to be the ones who discern and speak to the heart of the worldview, like Paul did. With globalization, there's almost like a justification, or like there's permission. Everybody's becoming like us, so why bother with the worldview? Everybody's speaking English, so we might as well meet them halfway and we'll use English instead of using their local language. I'm concerned myself that donor-driven and project-driven missions causes us as missionaries to neglect the worldview. Because when you use projects, or you feed people, or you start educating them, there's this kind of promise of upward mobility tends to lead to quick results. Because when you do things, projects, and that, you see change, but it's change on the outside. You can't see a man's heart. But on the outside, if he's getting along better and learning something in school, you begin to say, oh, there's so much change going on. And so because of that change, you feel like, well, I've been there, I've done that, I'm doing a good job. There's transformation happening. So therefore, I don't need to dive into the worldview so much, because look what's all going on. But in actuality, what seems to be happening is a superficial alignment with Christianity. But the worldview, how people intimately view and interact with life, has been untouched, unchallenged, and unchanged. Every Cambodian I know that came to Christ for the rice, for the land, for the glasses, for the free education, when they had a crisis, they were back to Buddhism as fast as they came to Christianity because of the perks and the benefits. And when you bring somebody into Christ superficially, but you don't answer the questions that drive them at night in bed when they're laying there and saying, I'm afraid of ghosts. Well, you don't need to address ghosts when you're addressing education, right? We're missing that worldview. In closing, I think of you were in Thailand, is that right? Yeah. So this is, you may know this story, but there was the gospel came to a particular group of Thais from the West. So these Thais were partially Thai, but adopted some of the Western Christianity culture. So now they're Thais in part West, and they went to the Isan people. And the Isan people are a tribal group within Thailand, but speak a different language. They're Lao speaking, I believe. But when the Thais went to share the gospel with the Isan, there was already double culture. See what I'm saying? The Isan people were getting the gospel in two different cultures, part Thai and part Western. So by the time they got the gospel, they didn't know anything. They're like, that's the foreigner's religion. Why should we believe that? Nonetheless, they gathered in churches and they sang in Thai, they sang in English, didn't sing in their heart language. Didn't use their own language. But you know what happened? One day, an old grandma stood up in the church, 90 years old, and began to dance in a Thai style and singing in the Thai music, or in the Lao, her own language. And everybody said, Grandma, sit down, you're embarrassing us. And she said, I'm not going to sit down. I am worshiping my God because I prayed for you to be here in church all these years and now you're here. And from that day on, they asked themselves, if Jesus were to come, Jesus came into the Jewish culture, what did Jesus behave and eat like and look like? And they began to look at it differently. If Jesus came into the Esan culture, what would Jesus eat like and look like? And they said enough of this, and they threw out all their Western music, they threw out all the Western forms, and they decided to write their own music and their own hymnology and sing their own music. And I just want to quickly read that song that they wrote. Unfortunately, it's in English. But you'll catch how it's lyrics, and it's for our sake so that we can understand how much it meant to them. From the heavenly city, the word came down. He was born right here where we live. We Esan people have new happiness now. He loves us, and that will not change. From the city above, he came down for us, full of love from the Almighty. Now listen, the sound of the ching, and the sound of the kang, and who is that playing the ping? Hear the clear tones of the bongolong as they join, I don't know all the sounds. And the sounds of the saw, the melody of the saw is coupled with the sound of voices of praise. The Lord Jesus Christ, the victor over death, is born in our cultural forms. This is their song that they wrote. Listen to the sounds of the flute and the drum. All Esan rejoices in him. Before, this church used to say, Jesus is the foreigner's God. Now they say, Jesus speaks our village talk. I challenge us to think about these issues, about local languages and local resources. I think if you ask me, there's some linguistics here, and I won't be able to match you in any form or fashion except that I learned a language. But it is my belief that as cross-cultural communicators, whoever's speaking, whatever language they're, I believe you're supposed to use the heart language right down to the level where they argue. If a man and a woman are behind their doors and they're arguing in Cambodia and they're arguing in Cambodian, that's their heart language. Because when you argue, what is it? You're arguing from your heart, your energy, your emotions. And so I believe you should bring God in the language where they argue, because then God will be the guard of their heart, their emotions, and their soul, and their mind. But it's really easy right now out there in this big bad world of globalization to say, well, they're learning English, they use English, why do we have to learn the language? But I challenge us to talk about these issues and think it through. So I leave you with that. Jim's going to come and...
those words with us. Opening our conference on an excellent tone there with some excellent points. Now we have some minutes for discussion, so those with questions they want to ask, this is your golden opportunity.
And I don't know about you, but I don't want to stand up here as the expert, because I think there's a lot of practitioners up here. So I can put in a few of my thoughts, but if you have thoughts about this question, let's dialogue about it. Because I think that's there's other questions, and I think that we're here to inform and help each other. You asked me what I've seen, so that's where I'll work from. I find that NGOs, it's very difficult to be vulnerable. And I say it's difficult because NGOs typically, for the most part, set up their NGOs based on their own culture, typically. And the funding, they get donors to fund what they're doing. And then we know that when, what is it, the pay the piper, pay the pipe, pay the, yeah, he, yeah, calls the tune. So NGOs, they're donor driven. So when there's donors, I mean, for example, in Cambodia, there was a clinic that was in a bit rough shape because if you paint something in Cambodia, 3 months later, it's peeling because of the humidity. But there was a donor coming, and so they had to go and paint it, spend money to paint it so it looked nice for the donor, so that the donor who drove by would know that his money's going to good use. So, and then also NGOs have structures and protocols and things that maybe aren't in accordance with the culture that need to be fulfilled because you're bringing, it's a complex structure. Now, whether they're on the ground grassroots, they're doing some vulnerable things. I've seen more and more leaning towards that. You have your transformational development where they try to stop asking the question, what do you need? Instead, what are your assets? So there's more and more of that. But overall, as an NGO, I think it's very tough to be vulnerable. That's...
I saw some of that when I went to Banda Aceh. I was in Banda Aceh, probably a year and 2 months after the tsunami. And by then, most of the relief work was gone. And the ones who were staying back were doing development work. And I saw one Indonesian pastor from Java who had left his home. He was supported by his home church and a few other churches in Java. And he was working with a Chinese Christian businessman who lived in Aceh. There were two Chinese churches in that entire, if you want to say, state of Indonesia. One was a Chinese Catholic, one was Chinese Protestant. Those were the two Christian churches before the tsunami, the only two churches that were known. And he worked with the Christian businessmen who were helping to finance various development projects in areas where they had opportunities of holding Bible studies and seeing churches develop. But it was done entirely within Indonesia. The funds weren't coming from the outside. And they were coming from Christians who were so afraid to ever witness. And they finally had an opportunity to work with this Indonesian to just start businesses. And one of the businesses was going to caves and collecting the guano and drying it out and selling it around the world because it's bat manure is some of the best manure in the world. And as they had worked, my students had worked with them for a day. Of course, we're wearing masks and the whole thing. And then we sat around and ate, and the students asked about the tsunami, and they told their story. And then afterwards, they said, we had no hope. And they talked about they had been told about Isa Hamasia, Jesus the Messiah, from this Indonesian who came to work with them. And today there's a church planted in this one village where all these were fishermen, and everyone was out on the boat, and when the tsunami came, they rose and they went down. All their families were waiting on the shore, and they came back and there were no families. They had relatives who have moved in from the inland to the coast, but they're still a mile from the shore now. But a church was planted simply because of local investments were made by local Christians. And a missionary came, but from Indonesia. By the way, the missionary who came from Indonesia, one thing was coming from the outside for him. The house that he was living in that housed not only a local group that met there, but his family and guests was financed by joint gifts from three missions in the United States. They purchased the building, and then they rented it out to him for some ridiculous rent, something like $50 a month, because that's what his supporters could afford. That was a small investment, but I'll tell you, it has been pretty successful. And he started nine churches. Nine of these underground churches that I'm sure they've been uncovered now, but I have students who want to do vulnerable mission but also want to work with NGOs, so that's why my real question is.
That's a good question. Because in that case, they were local NGOs. So would you be sending students to work with local NGOs or? Right, but I'm thinking, are your students international students or American? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Jean, one of the things I think is closely linked with lack of dependency is a sense of ownership. Could you just say something about how did you foster a sense of ownership amongst Cambodian people and the things you were doing?
Real quick, just to give you an example, there's a man who has a violin, and when he comes home from playing the violin, he throws it by the window and the rain falls on it. And then he drops it on the ground, he throws it, he doesn't take care of it, he neglects it. There's a second man, when he has his violin, he treats it like a baby. He puts it down, he covers it up, he's always polishing it. What's the difference? One man made his own violin. The other man was given the violin. So there's your ownership. So the way I established ownership in Cambodia is to, we say the word skin in the game. First of all, if it's my vision, and I say this is what I'd like us to do, then they're merely functionally helping support and do, you know, I pull them in. So this is my vision, I'd like to do this ministry. I want you to come along my side. It doesn't create psychological ownership, it creates functional ownership. We're in this as long as we get something. Jean will pay us, we'll be in it, but when Jean's gone, they're gone. So the way that I would cultivate local ownership is by, one, to make them dream their own visions of what they want to do. Come out of their own mouth and their own heart, we would like to take care of somebody with AIDS. So it came out of their conviction. Now, usually what we want to do as missionaries is say, oh, that's such a great idea. How about if I get some money from America and we start an AIDS orphanage? Then I've ruined the ownership. So the second way is just to cultivate and allowing them to come up with how they want to go about it with their local resources. And to be honest, it'll probably be one aid person. One person's with aid. Then you allow them to visit, to create their own plan to fulfill that own vision. And let it, there's two words that I use, reproducibility and paceability. Then allow them to grow that ministry at the pace where they can grow it. Because we tend to want to grow it, okay, you're only seeing two AIDS patients. If I get involved and bring my resources, you can see 20. But rather, let them go at their pace. And if it fails, what do I want to do? Don't let it fail, so I'll, again, pitch in. So I think I cultivated it by being low profile, letting them come up with their own visions and own ways to fulfill those visions. And me, what was my role? A cheerleader. You can do it. You can do it. You're amazing. This idea is incredible. Oh, but Jean over there, they have such, they have, they're like have an AIDS orphanage. We're only visiting one orphan. There was only one widow that gave one coin, and Jesus shouted her praises. There's only one woman who put an alabaster jar of perfume over Jesus' head and sang her praises. And you can do it. Those are some of the things of how I went to it.
Not so much a question, but just a further reflection on your question of international NGOs. I came late. My name is John Tuggy. I don't have my card yet. I haven't registered, so I probably shouldn't even be here. I could be an imposter for all you know. But I worked for an international NGO, Food for the Hungry, for 9 years in Cambodia. So I would just fully agree with what Jean is saying. I think the looking at it from perhaps a business perspective or an economics perspective, the critical pressure that a non-for-profit has, an NGO has, is they have two customers, and I think, I mean, we all know this, but it just helps to kind of lay it out. A local business has one customer, the person who's using and buying and paying for their product. A local NGO might have two customers, but it's a local who's paying for the product, and he's a neighbor to the person who's using the product. Does that make sense? Am I being too complicated? In other words, here in Britain, we might have some service provider for unwed mothers. Okay, the funding, that's a non-for-profit, but the funding from that comes from local churches in the very city where that same center is operating. Same culture, same language, perhaps a different socioeconomic status between the women who are using the services and those who are paying for it, but there's a lot of familiarity. They might even know each other. They might run into each other in the grocery store. An international not-for-profit has two sets of customers. One customer who pays for what they do in Britain and America. One customer who benefits from what they do in Cambodia and in, you know, Swaziland. And you could not get two more different customers on the face of the earth, as different as is physically possible on the earth. And the piper plays the tune is the customer in England and America. And the fact is, it's just human nature, when you have your attention divided between two customers who are completely opposite, the skill required to manage that relationship is almost beyond what any human can do. And so we end up paying more attention to, well, we got to take care of the bottom line. We got to stay in business. And so more and more attention gets paid to the customer who's paying for things in America and in Britain. That's just a reality that I've seen operate for a decade and more. So anyway.
Thank you, John. Other questions? Comments? Okay, while he's coming, anyone want to? You have a question to ask? Okay. So I didn't know, is it a technical thing or whether you were...
No, it's not technical at all. Hi, we run, amongst other things, a drug rehab centre in Spain, which to all intents and purposes will fit in this NGO thing. But people come to faith at this place because an integral part of this running is the sharing of the gospel in their daily devotionals. Yes, it's part-funded by Britain and America, and indeed Brazil, but it's also funded by the Land Use Sea and Government, who want a part of it. I think that's just amazing when a Catholic government pay for a project. But my point is, although as I fully accept what you say, but surely there is still a place for the project, provided the project is properly balanced and the focus of the project is still there. You see what I mean? So I would like to think that the NGOs wouldn't work. This is not a, well, I say it's not a government one, it's a mission organisation running it. But the local church grows, people come to faith with the work of this project, because that is the focus of it. That's the point of it. The drug rehabilitation is good, but the point of it is the sharing of the gospel. I don't know how that fits in with your... Sorry.
Thank you very much, Don. What we'll do, we'll take the question that Peter has, and then Gene will close by giving us the answers, and that will be...
Gene, just a question. The context of globalisation, the questions of governance and accountability, the exportation of what looks like a trendy fashions in governance, and the questions of accountability when we're looking at autochthonous leadership development. Any reflections on your experience, observation of those, and where vulnerability goes out the window, comes in the window, in those contexts?
Okay, so if Jean could answer those questions, then that will be the close of this session.
I guess I'll work backwards. Well, governance, that depends. Are you referring to the fact that, are you talking about partnerships where some of the governance comes from the outside? Yeah, it's quite complicated because, for example, I'm thinking of an example where in a particular context, they started Westerners, you're talking about Western governments, et cetera, that's passed down through the NGOs, and then the locals begin to adopt that, and it becomes their flavor. I can just think of one example where they were doing schools, and so the parents started sending their kids to school, and the school was set up according to the West. And so it was governed and everything was passed on from the NGOs on down. So it was done that way because it was exported in. And when what it did is when the students, the children started going to the school, it was run in a Western format. And so what happened is that where the children got all their moral training, okay, they got all their moral training at home because of the way the Western school goes, now they're getting their moral training at a Western institutionalized educational system. But because it conflicted with the culture, because it was at the home where the parents did the moral training, all these moral things started to go on. Kids were sleeping together at school, all the things that were unheard of. Because the school that was imported on down replaced the culture and the family system that was supposed to be the one to teach and guide their children on morality. So I don't think we can tackle, it's a huge issue and we can't tackle it. But all I want to leave with us is even though it's, the locals are saying, oh, this is the way to do it because this is how they do it in the West and globalization. We can't be fooled by the subjective and objective culture because the objective is, it's like an iceberg. So the objective is everything you can see on top. So it looks like in Cambodia, if you go there now, oh, they're into MTV, they're into everything the West does. Why don't I just behave like them because they behave like me, so I'll just be me because surely I'll be effective because they want to be like me. But if you go into the home, again, where they argue, or into their fields where they plow the field, under the iceberg is the part of the iceberg that's hiding in the water. And those are the values and the things that really drive them. Those don't often change. And that's where we have to minister to. We have to be careful not to say, oh, because it's globalization and everybody's buying into it, therefore let's just go and buy into it too. Because they may be buying into it at a certain level, but they're not necessarily buying it into it at a grassroots level. And that's where the gospel needs to get, to have long-term transformation. I don't know about you, but in Cambodia, it's almost like it was an unreached people group, and now it's almost nominal Christians already, because the depths of the spirituality and transformation is so superficial. That question? Yes, people can be led to Christ through almost anything. That's not the point of what we're making here, but for me, it wasn't a matter of a particular NGO or a particular ministry being able to lead people to Christ. But it was always a more primary goal is how can the Cambodians win people to Christ, and how can they plant their own churches and multiply. I can go to Cambodia honestly and do anything I want and make it work because I'm a hero and a foreigner, and they'll follow along. But when they turn to do it in the next village, doesn't work for them. And so what I'm telling them is, sorry, I have news for you today. Did you know that the Americans and the Westerners, the Britons, we own the Great Commission? We finance the whole thing. It's up to us, you know? We have to be careful to make sure that that's not what's going on.
Thank you very much, Jean. A round of applause, and then we have 12 minutes.